The hour of 10:15 having arrived, we will call the tax community to order when we have a quorum. So welcome to the tax committee, Commissioner Bowerly and Deputy Commissioner Cummings. We're glad you're here today. When we do get a quorum, Commissioner, I suppose for the record, I should, Mr. Cummings, what are we calling you today?
Tax policy manager or Mr. Cummings is fine.
Mr. Cummings is here from the department. Thanks, Paul. So with that, we will, what we're doing today, just so members know, is we're having a presentation on the governor's proposed budget here, tax aids, credits, and refunds. And it's my intention, Commissioner Bowerly has another commitment at about 20 after 11, so that's fine. She will go, and then we'll see where we're at. Mr. Cummings can continue at that point. We'll see where we're at, because when it comes to the governor's budget proposals or on the tax aids and credits, I don't want to push it. I don't want to rush it. I want them to give their full presentation. I want members to be able to ask questions. And so if we're not done today, we're going to come in tonight and go till midnight till we get it done. No, just kidding. If we don't get it done today, members, what we'll do is we would pick it up in one of the committee at the regular scheduled times next week. So that's kind of where we're at. So I don't want to be pushing this too hard. There's some very interesting proposals in here, and so I want the committee members to understand them fully. So with that,
do we have a quorum?
Okay. Commissioner, as soon as we have a quorum, I'll be interrupting and calling the meeting officially to order and take care of a few housekeeping things. So with that, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Cynthia Bowerly. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Revenue. And with me today is Paul Cummings, the Department's Tax Policy Manager, or as he is known in this committee, the Deputy. Thank you, first of all, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, for allowing me to present the tax provisions of Governor Deaton's budget to you today.
Hey, Commissioner, excuse me. We have a quorum. I'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. Thank you, Representative.
I'll move approval of the minutes if you like.
Yes, let's do that. Representative Erickson moves the minutes from January 22nd of 2015. Any additions or corrections? Not all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Chair Erickson, for that. Item next, Commissioner Bowerly, if you please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We appreciate the opportunity to share with you the items in the governor's tax policy budget with you and look forward to discussing them, answering your questions, and providing you with information. Before we get started on the provision, one provision of the governor's tax bill has actually already passed. I want to thank you for your work in federal conformity. It is a part of the governor's budget. The item that you see in the budget is the conformity bill that was already passed. As a result of your quick action, over 200,000 Minnesotans are able to take advantage of these tax reductions for this filing year. And just to give you a quick update of why that quick work was so important, we have 77 filing days remaining in this year's tax filing season, numbers that only a Department of Revenue would love. We have already sent out 19,000 refunds to Minnesotans. So many Minnesotans were eager and ready to file, and we were able to get those processed, and your early conformity work has allowed us to be able to process those and get those out the door. So I want to thank all members of this committee. I particularly want to thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you had talked about warp speed, and you demonstrated what that looks like. And so not only does this do great things for people in Minnesota, but it really does streamline the way that we are able to engage with taxpayers this year. So on behalf of the governor, Mr. Chairman, I would like to present you with a signing pen. He was able to sign the bill on Saturday when it was presented to him from the revisor's office. And I actually have two pens from that signing, Mr. Chairman, and so I wanted to inquire as to who else should receive one of those pens from the governor.
Do you have them
here? I have them with me.
What do they look like? Sharpies?
They're Sharpies that say Governor Mark Deaton on them.
Oh, it says his name on them?
Yes.
That's pretty cool. I've got one from Governor Plenty when we signed the ethanol legislation. It
It goes in my trophy case. Well, you put me on the spot here. I think it would make sense, since this bill passed and it took both sides to suspend the rules, it took both sides to agree to no amendments. I think the ranking lead Democrat on the committee should receive the other pen. Wow, how's that for a quick decision?
that's warp speed. And Mr. Chairman, I personally would agree with you. It's a fine decision. We really do thank former Chair Lynchesky for her work in this and in past years. And frankly, I think helping educate everyone about why this is so important to do quickly. May I share
the maybe a page could deliver?
Thank you very much.
No, thank you. That's very kind. I got to see this pen here.
Perhaps it could make it in the trophy case.
We're not messing with gift bands here. Let's see, it's under $5.
I believe it is under $5.
Are you a registered lobbyist?
I am not a registered lobbyist. And I do want to note for the record that it is not my intention to provide gifts at every time I appear before the committee.
You're on the roll.
I do want to make sure we're not setting a precedent that I cannot.
Well, Commissioner, you certainly don't have to, but it sure helps.
I understand.
Okay, this is under the gift ban. These were on sale at $129 at Staples the other day, I saw. Okay, but not with the governor's name on them. So, Representative Lynchesky, you got that?
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And on behalf of all of us in the minority, thank you. It is good that we got this done quickly, and I think it passed unanimously off the House floor. So thank you for that, and thank you, Commissioner, and pass on the thanks to the governor. I have to say, the commissioner may not know about you and pens, Mr. Chair. And sometime maybe you should show her your pens, which if you don't know the chair, you got to check out all his pens. But, you know, Governor Pawlenty's always, I have a few of those too from getting bills signed with him, and his were blue Sharpies, right?
If I've got some of those, yes.
So I don't know what that says about these governors that, I don't know, Dayton's black and Pawlenty was blue, but sometime, Mr. Chair, I think the commissioner should see, or maybe you could tell us about you and pens.
Well, I do, you know, I collect golf clubs. I've got 149 drivers, 18 full tournament sets, and some would say that's obsessive compulsive. I call it a collection. And I also like pens, like the Mont Blancs, and as over, see, I've got some. I didn't know Rolex made pens. Did you know that, Riffin of Lesh? Rolex pens and Watermans and all those. So I kind of like those pens. So, but this one is very special. This goes right up next to this will go by the Mont Blancs. Where this will go. That's where that goes. So thank you very much. And Chair Lynchesky, you know, seriously, you know, I kept saying warp speed, you know, put it on the fast track, whatever. And that wouldn't have happened without your leadership. It wouldn't have happened. We had to suspend the rules. We had to make sure there's no amendments. And so those things working together, I like seeing that passed on there right there. So, Commissioner Bowerly, if you could please proceed.
Thank you,
and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee. Before diving into the tax policy items in the budget, we just wanted to give you a quick reminder of where we are. So this the state's financial state is in a different place than we faced 2, 4, or 6 years ago. And the governor announced that the surplus that we do have, he is investing in Minnesota's families, its children, through education from preschool to higher education, tax cuts for middle-class families who are struggling to pay for child and dependent care, and to provide services for poor elderly and those in need of other services. So we obviously are, the tax bill, of course, reflects the difference in where we are in our financial state as well. So a little bit more detail on this. So as you can see of the surplus number is about 137. You'll see reflected on here and a little more. There is an amount about $34 million being held in reserve for Minsky, as the governor described in more detail yesterday. But the key piece here is that 75% of the investments in this of the surplus are going towards education, families in form of tax relief, and investments in health and human services to provide services for low-income families, for increasing the state's investment in children's mental health services, dental care for children, and enhancing the child's protection efforts. I'll now go into the transportation proposal, which the governor announced on Monday with Commissioners Zelli and Dunick and the Chair Dunick from the Met Council. There is a tax provision in there, and so I'd like to share that detail with you today. The transportation proposal aims to invest about over $6 billion over the next 10 years in roads, bridges, and transit across the state. A portion of that funding would come from a gross receipts tax. Gross receipts tax would be a 6.5% tax on the annual per gallon wholesale price of gasoline. That would be set that every year the Department of Revenue would apply that amount to the annual wholesale price of gasoline that is set by the U.S. Energy Information Office. So it's a regional number that is set annually, so it would change once a year. The proposal has a 250 floor per gallon of that wholesale price, so the 6.5 would be applied to either 250 or to a higher rate if the per gallon price was higher. That will result in a minimum increase of 16 cents per gallon, and we expect that the distributors who pay this would pass that on to consumers at the pump. And this provision will raise about $4.4 billion in new revenue over 10 years. And the reason that this is slightly different than the gas tax, it changes with the gas prices, and that will make this funding stream more sustainable for our transportation investments, largely because the costs associated with those are also driven by energy costs, the fuel costs associated with building roads, the costs for asphalt, which is largely made up of oil, also fluctuate with those prices. So this will be able to capture that revenue going forward. As you can see, it will result in a significant investment in the state's roads, bridges, and other infrastructure over 10 years. This is spread across the state of Minnesota. Maps are available. We're happy to provide those to you if you want more detail about your particular area in terms of what investments would look like in your particular districts. It does also have a half-cent sales tax in the metro area to help pay for transit in the metro area. It would also be supported by an increase in motor vehicle tab fees. So we can provide you with additional detail on those non-tax items, non-gross receipts tax items, if you'd like more detail. I'd next like to address the child and dependent care proposal. The governor is proposing to spend about $100 million to increase this eligibility for this existing credit, to increase it from 38,000 families to 130 families. Families that are currently eligible would be able to see an increase in the amount of the credit that they could receive. And there would be also 92,000 new Minnesota families who would be eligible for this credit. And this credit allows them to recover some of the costs that they are spending to care for their children or, for some families, care for an elderly person in the home. The credit would phase out at $112,000 for families with one child and $124,000 for families with two or more children. Minnesota faces high costs in child care. We're ranked fourth highest in the state. Quality child care is, of course, essential to families. It's important for parents when they're going to work to know that their children are well cared for and safe. And last week when we rolled out this proposal, I was able to meet two Minnesota families who would be affected by this proposal. One was a single mother who made the difficult decision to leave her job as an executive assistant because the child care costs were so high that she couldn't make the rest of her bills, she couldn't pay the rest of her bills with her salary. This credit, increased credit for her, would allow her to get back into the workforce because she'd be able to afford her child care. And another mother that I met last week, after having her second child, their family determined that her going back to work even part-time as a physical therapist would essentially earn as much as the child care would cost. And for someone in a field like that, keeping up with their credentials is very important. She wants to work because she's in a profession where she cares for people. It was important to her that she be able to get back to work and maintain her credentials, and this new eligibility for her family will allow her, it will make financial sense for them for her to go back to work. So as you can see from the chart, our current existing law is in red, and the blue shows the expansion. So families at lower income levels will be able to achieve that higher credit, and again, it does phase out at certain income levels depending on the number of children. We think this is an important way to invest in Minnesota families and would provide $100 million in tax relief for Minnesota families. The next proposal I'd like to share with you is about railroad property tax. There are two provisions in Minnesota law that are outdated and not consistent with the way that other states are taxing railroad property in the state. The first is about what property of a railroad we are taxing. Right now, Minnesota does not tax rolling stock, trestles, or bridges that are owned by railroads. We are one of a handful of states that does not tax rolling stock. So this proposal would look to expand that base. It also would replace an obsolete calculation with how we value railroad property and allow for a more updated methodology that is being used across the country. Right now, Minnesota uses something called the Wisconsin Blue Chip Method. It is a complicated formula whereby in Wisconsin, they determine different profits, which railroad companies are profitable for certain segments of the corporate activities. And then the most profitable pays the most tax, and then it goes down from there. Wisconsin doesn't even use this method anymore, and we think it's time for Minnesota to move on and join other states in how we would value that property. The railroads, I would appreciate a modern method of valuation. We would expect that, you know, we would need to have conversations about expanding the base of that, but certainly getting Minnesota in pace with other states is important in this space. And then the governor's proposal is to this would increase the revenue, the taxes that the railroads are paying in Minnesota. That would have an effect across the state because they pay not only into the statewide levy, but they also, of course, pay at the local level as well. And so communities could decide to offer that increased revenue and share that as property tax relief to homeowners and businesses at that local level. At the state level, the governor is proposing to increase the levy and capture that revenue for the general fund. So the next page that you have shows you the amount of money that would be available to counties, cities, and other taxing jurisdictions. And so if they had levy room available, they could either raise that levy to capture that that revenue for how they see fit, or they could share that relief with the other taxpayers in their levy. The next item is actually a set I'd like to share with you. We're calling it corporate tax reform. It's a couple of proposals that really are aimed at making sure that Minnesota's corporate tax provisions keep pace with some of the trends in business practices. The governor is also proposing to change the research and development credit to allow more companies to access the credit. These proposals are small in the number of taxpayers that they would affect at this point in time. We think it's about 100 taxpayers at this point in time, but these are growing trends. And so as you see, as you'll see when we're able to provide the estimates, it grows over time because we think that there are more and more companies who are taking advantage of these expanding loopholes, if you will, in some provisions of Minnesota law. So on the next page, I'll go through each of these for you, and of course we can answer any questions you have as well. The first one is about the research and development credit, and we know that in our experience in administering this credit, there are companies who no longer have records about their base year, and the base year is important because the credit is available to companies who increase their research expenses and activities. So We have found that companies may not have documentation from their early years of investment. Some of these base years go back to the mid-80s, and so the department is in a position where we need to disallow this credit. This proposal would allow companies to take 16% as their base year of their as a representation of their investment in research activities, and it also corresponds to the minimum credit available. So companies would be able to achieve a larger credit if they have documentation that demonstrates their initial investment was low, started at a lower percentage. If they had initial investment of 10% in research activities and they grew from there, they could still capture the larger credit. But this would put us in a position where we would be able to allow it for companies even if they did not have documentation from a long time ago. The next provision would modify the definition of financial institution to include partnerships and limited liability companies. This provision would remove the advantage of transferring loans and interest income to an affiliated partnership or LLC, which is not treated as a financial institution, and it would essentially allow would disallow a practice that we are starting to see where a financial institution might set up a partnership in another state and then be able to shelter that income from the apportionment when they consider their their income in Minnesota for tax purposes. So we would, again, this is a very small number of instances that we're seeing right now, but we are concerned that it could grow over time. Another provision that is that we would like to address in this proposal is we are starting to see instances where a company that is located in Minnesota and is sold, and then the taxpayer might structure the sale so that the payments are received a number of years later after they have established residency in another state. So this would recognize the tax at the time of the sale. This is really about the timing of when that sale takes place, so that a later move that really is aimed at avoiding that tax could be captured for Minnesota. There's another provision that we call economic substance that would allow the department to look at a transaction and determine if it has a business purpose or if the purpose is only to avoid tax. A number of states allow for this this economic substance doctrine, so we can look at the transactions to determine whether it is really there's some profit motive or it's some business-related reason, or if there is if this is simply to avoid taxes. This is something that again is we don't see a lot of right now, but is a growing concern of the departments. Another provision deals with non-admitted insurance companies, and this, like the financial institution, we are starting to see instances where insurance companies who are not actually providing insurance products to any member of the public, but they create an insurance company to avoid paying corporate tax on the proceeds in that insurance company. Insurance companies pay premium taxes, as you know, and do not pay corporate franchise tax. And so if a company were to set up an insurance company, they could move income into the insurance company, but non-Minnesota insurance companies do not pay premium tax, and so they would be able to shelter that income from their Minnesota corporate tax by setting up an insurance company outside of the state of Minnesota. Two other small provisions relate to dividends and the deduction from debt finance stock, and clarifications about derivatives and sales factors. These are very small provisions, again, clarifications that we think get back to the intent of the original law and just to keep up with existing trends that we are seeing and to remove unintended benefits to corporations for the dividends from debt finance stock and for the sales factor, for the derivatives and sales factor. What we're seeing, as you know, corporations pay corporate tax here in Minnesota based on the sales in Minnesota, and that is in relationship to their sales across the United States. Derivatives, which is a business practice that many businesses engage in, often transact in New York. It is a futures market. And so the effect of that is it really dilutes their sales factor here in Minnesota. And so we would look to exclude that from the sales factor when we are looking at corporate income. So those provisions fit together. Again, they don't affect very many taxpayers at this point in time, but we see growing trends in this space, and so do want to kind of tighten up our laws and bring them back to some of the original intention of what the legislature passed when Minnesota established those tax statutes. The next item I'd like to talk with you about is the governor's proposal to stop tobacco smuggling. As you know, the tobacco rates were increased a couple of years ago, and we are now starting to see smuggling coming into the state. We are seeing untaxed tobacco in retail locations, and recently State Patrol stopped a budget rental box van, for speeding and asked some questions and asked to look inside. And the picture you have before you is what they found inside that box van. Tobacco product here in Minnesota that at this point allegedly did not have the appropriate Minnesota tax paid on it. And what we are kind of most concerned about is that this is fundamentally unfair to those businesses who are complying with Minnesota law to be competing with smuggled and contraband product. So the proposal would enhance the revenue team's capacity to work with retailers to follow up on leads from retailers who are maybe being approached by smugglers to sell this product, to inspect retail locations to find this product. It would also establish a statewide license for retailers. At this point in time, retail licenses are held at the local level. And we have a number of jurisdictions who are very helpful when it comes to enforcing this with respect to contraband product sales. Other jurisdictions have different laws with respect to how they govern their retail licenses. And so there's a variety, and again, retailers in one location or one jurisdiction may be being treated very differently than others. So we'd like to bring some consistency to that. We would ensure that it is a very easy electronic license that is very easy to administer for those retailers. It would not be a paper form. We do most of our business now with businesses online. It would allow us to have some ability to control and to revoke licenses were a retailer to not follow the law in this space. It would also increase penalties for noncompliance with tobacco laws. Other tax laws have more significant penalties, and we think that these tax laws should be treated the same. The next set of those are sort of the major proposals that are in the governor's budget. The next set of proposals are what we view as really updates and corrections to the tax code. They are small changes, but they are important to keeping the tax code working smoothly. So the first one deals with solid waste management. Minnesota's rate for solid waste management, which is $2 per ton, has remained the same for nearly 20 years. And of course, many things have changed since then, including costs with respect to these practices and waste collection. And what we are seeing is, as a result of this, demolition waste is not being treated the same as industrial waste. And so we would propose that we make that consistent and update that rate. And so we would be looking at something more in the ballpark of $2.50 a ton rather than $2 a ton. So it's not a dramatic increase, but it does keep pace. And we think it will allow businesses operating in the same space, both in demolition and industrial, to have the same rates applied to them. This proposal would also allow for an update to this rate to be made on an ongoing basis from the Department of Revenue and the Department of and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The next provision deals with the estate tax recapture provision and its interaction with eminent domain. Again, this is not a proposal that addresses a lot of people, but for the families that it does impact, it's very important to them. We have had a couple of instances. Again, it's not a lot. As you know, for inherited farm property, for example, the family must retain ownership and maintain tillable farmland for 3 years after a decedent's death. If a county or a locality comes in and takes part of that farm for a road or a bridge or a school, that land no longer is tillable farmland, and so the department has to disallow that. So this would be a correction. We don't think this is what was intended, and certainly seems unfair to those families, and so the governor is proposing that we clarify that, it would remove the recapture tax if it were taken for eminent domain purposes. The next provision deals with motor vehicle leases. This has no impact on taxpayers. This is correcting some text so that the revenue from motor vehicle leases can follow the intended purposes of the Legacy Act funds. So right now, the transportation and transit accounts are the text directs us to provide all those funds to the transportation and transit accounts rather than the 6.5%, with the 3.75% going to the legacy funds. So this is a correction. It doesn't raise new revenue, but it does shift it from one account to another. The compressed natural gas definition is something that also needs to be updated. The governor's proposal is to adopt the International Fuel Tax Agreement and IRS standard. This would make it simpler and easier for businesses. Industry is supportive of this proposal because they would no longer have to engage in two calculations, one for the IRS under the IFTA and one with the department, with Minnesota's statute in place. And so we think this is a benefit to taxpayers and keeps up with where the rest of the country is in terms of how this is taxed. The next set of proposals we categorize in sort of a tax fairness space. The first is a change to an existing program. Minnesota's senior citizens who may be having trouble paying their property taxes are eligible to participate in a tax deferral program. It should allow them to pay their taxes, we would help them pay their taxes, and then they would pay the state back as they're able or upon the sale of their home. This would allow seniors to stay in their homes. As the department has been administering this, we have been observing that this is not as widely used due to two of the provisions that are in the statute. One is that the statute requires 15 years of occupancy in the home before you're eligible for this program. And that has been, historically, people stayed in their homes a long time. Now we see people moving more frequently. And so someone may have downsized after their children left their home, and now they've been in their home for 5 years and are not eligible for this program. So the governor's proposing to change that occupancy requirement to 5 years to allow for more seniors to participate. The other proposal is to move the application deadline from July 1st to November 1st. Many seniors may not realize that they need this help until they get their second half tax bill in October. And when they call us at that point, we are required to tell them that the application date is July, so we can get them signed up for the next July. But even though the department could actually process it by November 1st to deal with that second half property tax bill, the deadline in the statute is July 1st. So this proposal would move it to November 1st because that's really when most seniors, when they get that second half bill, that's when they realize that they may need some help. So we think this would be an improvement and allow more seniors to be able to take advantage of this program. The next provision deals with the home office deduction. There are two options for Minnesotans if they have a home office and how they can deduct that from their taxes. One is fairly new. The IRS in 2013 allowed for a simplified version of calculating that deduction. And what this proposal would do would be to align that method of calculation with how it intersects with the property tax refund claim. So under the initial Minnesota way to calculate your home office deduction, you were also instructed if you were filing for a property tax refund that you would you would allocate out that part that was related to your business, because the property tax refund is really about your the home use of that property. But for this new simplified method, we need to update the direction to taxpayers to ensure that they also take out that business portion from their property tax refund claim. So this would treat taxpayers the same for property tax refund purposes, regardless of which choice they made about how to calculate their home office deduction, which is available, you know, Minnesotans should have that option, but then whichever option they choose, they should be treated the same for property tax refund purposes. And the last proposal that I'd like to talk with you about today is about disallowance of the working family credit for full-year non-residents. Minnesota's working family credit is available to full-year non-residents, so people who are not Minnesota residents full-time or part-time. And what this means in practicality is that Minnesota residents who work in Wisconsin residents who work in Minnesota receive the credit from both Wisconsin and from Minnesota. And a Minnesota resident who works in Wisconsin is only eligible for the Minnesota credit. It's our understanding that the intention of a tax expenditure like this credit was to benefit Minnesotans, and so this proposal would bring that credit back to Minnesotans. We also have a challenge with administering the credit as it currently exists, because when someone is not a Minnesota taxpayer, they're actually a resident of another state, it is harder for us to follow up on any fraudulent returns or get money back from them if they were claim the credit in error. So for a visual on this, the current law allows a Wisconsin taxpayer to take both the Wisconsin credit and the Minnesota credit, which, as you'll note, is a little more generous than Wisconsin's, while Minnesota residents are only eligible for the Minnesota credit. And so our proposal would just really streamline that. So Minnesota residents, part year or full year Minnesota residents, would retain eligibility, but we would disallow it for the full year non-residents. So that change, we think, brings that back to where the state probably intended those funds to be going. It is about $5 million a year, and so that is money that obviously we can certainly spend in other places. So those are some of the details of the proposals that will be in the tax bill itself. There are a number, the transportation bill I would expect would, you know, also have interest in other committees as well. We recognize that the cigarette proposal will also have interest in other committees as well, but wanted to share all of that with you today. So we would be happy to provide additional information or to answer questions.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. A very good job. I've got a couple quick questions here, and then I've got a list started here. I've got the gentleman from Lyon, Representative Wills, and Chair Loon here, and then and then Representative Anderson. So we'll work through this. And again, we don't have to push here, because if we need another meeting to go over that, this is some very important things here. First of all, to the Commissioner, do you have an estimate as to when you might have this in bill form, so that research can better look at things, Commissioner?
We hope in the next week or so. Do we have a deadline of the 11th? And we're hoping to have it to you before then.
Okay, thank you. A couple things here. I was looking at the tobacco smuggling thing, and I guess the moral of the story is, if you're breaking law, don't speed, maybe? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Would have got by with it just fine. So you mentioned that some folks in the structuring the sale of a company are not taking any payment till like 3 years out, so they could clearly establish residency someplace else. Florida, Texas, South Dakota, no state income tax. I guess I never thought of that. That's kind of cool. Have you seen much of that, or there must be some?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. members of the committee, we were not intending to give anyone good ideas. we have seen instances of this, and as you know, I can't talk with you about any particular taxpayers, but we are seeing instances of this, and in the department's experience, things tend to grow over time, and so we wanted to bring this to you as in terms of making sure that we can try to end this behavior, because it really is about the timing of the transaction and making sure that it captures the reality of when the transaction took place.
So, Commissioner, this wouldn't really affect somebody that maybe sells a company in November and has to decide if they want to finalize it December 31st or January 1st. We're not talking about that.
No, we are not talking, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This would be about those installment sales or sales that are structured to push over time. If you're deciding whether one tax year versus another tax year in Minnesota, this would not affect that.
Okay. Quickly on the estate tax recapture eminent domain now. That was something for the 2011 tax bill, I believe, where the estate tax would go up to the federal level if it was for family farm staying in the family for 3 years. So what you're saying is the way I wrote that, no, the way the legislature passed it is that if, let's say, there's an eminent domain, somebody needs to, the high school wants to build a football field, and so they take part of a person's farm, they lose the whole thing. Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, they would lose the whole thing. And we would agree with you that that certainly wouldn't have been the intention of that eminent domain would interact in that way. Eminent domain is for a public good, and those decisions made at the local level shouldn't necessarily impact. If you're not able to have tillable land, that's not really your fault.
Well, I hope that can get in the House tax bill. Okay, the other issue, insurance companies, non-admitted carriers. Could you explain that a little bit further? Then we'll get into questions from members.
Sure. And if
what are we doing here?
If you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask some others from the Department of Revenue to join us to get into the details of non-admitted insurance companies. Jeremy can introduce himself for the record and then provide any detail you want on this proposal.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeremy Iden. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome, committee, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, so on the insurance part of it, they're setting up a non-admitted carrier, mm-hmm. but now are we going to get in trouble with retaliatory taxes on this since it's the Commerce Clause and all this? It's not that I'm paranoid, it just seems like everybody's after me, and anytime we start talking about retaliatory taxes, I get really nervous because that really hurts our domestics.
Mm-hmm.
Does that play in here at all?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, it does not. This will be specifically written to keep out any companies that are subject to or will be subject to the retaliatory tax. So insurance companies that are subject to the retaliatory tax are companies that are admitted to sell insurance.
Oh, so these are non-admitted carriers?
Correct.
Oh, okay. I got a phone call yesterday, and the person on their side said, Chairman Davids, I have your Mexican Coke. And I thought I could just see cameras, and I thought, oh, Mexican Coke. But what I did was for one of our research people wanted Mexican Coke because it's real sugar in there. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to stop by afterwards and share some Mexican Coke with me, it's chilled perfectly at 34.5 degrees. It's delicious. And, of course, I like Coke with corn syrup a little better because of the corn from the Minnesota. Yeah. Corn growers, you got to be a little careful around here. Okay, so Mexican Coke, that kind of scared me, but it's all good. It's all good. I don't want to be the front page of the paper for that. Okay, questions? The gentleman from Lyon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got a couple. Just kind of going back to page 6, your slide on the estate tax recapture eminent domain. You talk about eminent domain, but one of the questions I have was kind of along the lines of just state acquisition to land in general. So whether it be due process from eminent domain, whether it be a road project, but what about potential state mandates? So it's been from the state mandate for solar energy, it's estimated 11,000 acres of farmland will be purchased and then put into solar through state mandate. And wanted to see how that would potentially affect those lands, if it were to happen to fit into this area, and then also if land would be then sold to like Pheasants Forever, and then transferred to the DNR, if that would be affected too for the thousands of acres that will be purchased essentially by the state through other entities.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman and members,
you can certainly join us, sir. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members, the voluntary sales of land would not be included, but I'm going to ask Mr. Mahoney, one of our lawyers, to provide you with more detail.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John O'Mahoney. I'm an attorney for the Department of Revenue. The way that the provision is currently drafted, certain sales that were of a compulsory nature, even if they weren't through an eminent domain proceeding, would still be covered and therefore not subject to the recapture, and that was a consideration that we had.
The gentleman from Lyon?
Okay. That's what I figured. All right.
You had another question?
Yes, I do, sir.
Gentleman from Lyon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just going along some of the modernization for the railroad property taxes, talking about the portion of rolling stock and trestles and bridges, rolling stock meaning probably the train itself. Being part of agriculture, also propane issues that have been facing our state, and then the competition with oil cars going through our state for moving grain to market. It's been an issue that our elevators and our ag industries have faced. Do you feel this modernization when it comes to property taxes, do you suppose that would discourage rolling stock from being placed in the state of Minnesota by making it more expensive, or will this make it less expensive to keep rolling stock in the state?
Commissioner Bowerly?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the railroads in Minnesota have talked about increasing their capacity to address some of the needs, and I know that has been an area of concern. I don't think I'm in a position to determine what their price points are, what their profit margins are, to the extent that this would change would it affect their capacity to operate in Minnesota.
Gentleman from Lyon.
Thank you.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a couple of questions, Commissioner Bowerly. First one was on the slide on the tobacco smuggling. And I guess I'm just curious with the ideas proposed to address the smuggling, how much that's going to cost, how much of the $440 million from the tobacco increase we had in 2013 is going to go towards paying to actually enforce collecting the taxes?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wills, member of the committee, there would be an investment in the Department of Resources, in the Department of Revenue, in terms of additional personnel that would be needed. But the estimate that has been we are developing for this would also bring in additional tax dollars, because we would drive that product towards taxed product rather than untaxed product. So there is a net revenue, actually, of this proposal to bring in additional revenue to the state.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on that, and then I'll have another question on another slide. When you say personnel, how many employees, what would the salary be? How much is the cost before we're considering the revenue that
sure.
we would collect?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wills, we are the governor's proposal is to add about 11 individuals to this tobacco enforcement team. They would be made up of members of our existing tobacco team would be enhanced to provide for more interaction with retailers, more capacity to go out and do inspections, to administer, have a closer relationship with the retailers that were administering this, and then with the tobacco distributors who are actually purchasing the cigarette stamps and paying the tax on the on the tobacco product, and then to investigate the any violations that we find.
Representative Wills.
Thank you for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm still not hearing how much would it cost to pay those 11 employees.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wills, I apologize. It's about a the FTEs are about 11, and it's I'm going to check my number. I think it's about a it's a little over $1 million. For those FTEs and for the other, you know, we would need to enhance some of our technology and things like that. So that is also includes some other costs for the agency.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I appreciate that information. I think it's helpful for us to understand the full picture when we're discussing that. And then I had a question on the child and dependent care credits. My understanding is that is only available, is that just for married couples, or what's available if a family chooses to live off of one income and one parent stays home, or in the situation where you have a single parent, like a single mom, and you know she's required to work, but there's not another spouse. How does that work?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wills, members of the committee, there is no requirement for the sort of shape of the family. So if it is a single parent, that individual would certainly be able, and they have child care expenses, they certainly would be able to take advantage of the credit. So it does, I mentioned two families that I met with. One was a single mother, and she had to make that choice because she just couldn't pay for her expenses when she was at work, and now she can go back to work and have her child in care. And another was a family where the husband was working, and the mother was working part-time, and she really wanted to go back to work, but the cost just didn't make sense. So, and particularly with this proposed expansion, right now the income cap of $39,000 is a very narrow place, and so this really expands it to many more middle-income families and will allow for them to take advantage of that credit.
Representative Wells.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to clarify, what about in a situation where there is a married couple but only one of them is working, can they still take advantage of the credit if they choose to do that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Wills, yes, they certainly can. And the income you can either, the income of the family is either joint or attributable to the, if there's only one earner.
Representative Wills.
Thank you. I just wanted to fully understand how that worked. Thanks.
Chair Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Commissioner, for your testimony. I'm sorry I missed the beginning, but just a question on the disallowance of the working family credit. And it sounds like, is this primarily a Wisconsin-Minnesota issue to the large extent?
It exists with other states as well, but Wisconsin is the state where it's most acute because they allow their residents to take both. So it certainly does exist with a couple of other of our neighboring states. It's just most acute with Wisconsin. We're not picking on Wisconsin. We're just, it's most acute with that because they allow for both.
Chair Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so is this tied at all to the fact that we don't have a reciprocity agreement with Wisconsin any longer? Commissioner?
Commissioner Bowerly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, it is not tied to reciprocity. It doesn't have any...
It will be. Oh, excuse me. Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we certainly recognize that it raises the issue of reciprocity, but the proposal can move forward with or without a reciprocity agreement in place with Wisconsin.
Chair Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
That's a very good point. And that's, as I was reading this last night, that's one of the first things that kind of popped up at me was that's just about what we actually need probably for reciprocity. And I noticed that in, as I was reading this last night, there's no reciprocity in here. And then I was horrified, mortified, and terrified that it wasn't in here. But then I got to thinking, it's already the law.
Chair Lincheski last year was very kind and in the conference committee report put some funds towards that. And Commissioner Bauer, I appreciate your efforts so far with the department over in Wisconsin. This is something that's it's a very big issue, and the Duluth area, southeast Minnesota, it's a big deal. So I think I just found the money to take care of it. That's two separate issues, of course. I just hope it gets in the tax bill from the House. Okay.
Mr.
Chair Loon, or Commissioner Bowerly.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Wills, I need to, this is the reason the deputy is here with me today. I misstated the answer to your question. Your question was about if there are two parents in the family, do both of them have to be working to be eligible for the credit? And I was wrong. They actually do both need to be working to take advantage of the credit.
Representative Wills, to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that clarification, because that's how I thought I understood it, and so I think that's good to have on the record. And because I have spoken with constituents who have been frustrated with that, mm-hmm. and I don't know if that's something that can be addressed. I know it's probably outside the scope of this, but there are a lot of families who choose to do that and feel like they're being left out and not seeing the help that they need because they've made a personal decision that way. So. That's a conversation for another day. Thank you.
Just remember, Representative Wills, we're the tax committee. We can do whatever we'd like.
Well, I might come back to this one.
Okay. Representative Loon, you were finished. Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson, Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have two questions. I'm going to go back to the disallowance on the working family credit. As I understand it, the U.S. Constitution requires us to treat everyone equitably, whether you're a resident or non-resident of the state. And it sounds like there's other states besides Wisconsin that are kind of doing this despite the U.S. Constitution. You know, do we have a fallback plan if the feds decide to say, hey, you can't do this anymore? And do we know how we would fill in that gap of, you know, just over $10 to $11 million? What's kind of our plan B if this doesn't pan out for us and that the feds crack the whip, so to speak?
Commissioner Bowerly?
Mr. Chairman, Chair Anderson, we are currently spending that money, if you will, under the current provision. So this would make that change and result in a reduction in the expenditure for this credit right now. We are not aware that this would raise any issues, but certainly we can go back to our legal team and confirm that.
Chair Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, that would be helpful. I just, you know, I'd worry that the feds will decide to get strict on some of these things, then we're going to be left with a bill at some point. But the other question I had was on the solid waste provision. Are we talking about increasing people's garbage bills? I assume the way that it's worded, that the $2 is 20 years old, that it's only going to go up. So how will this impact an individual homeowner's garbage bill? How will this impact home construction? How will this impact our road construction as well, with both the construction and demolition waste being changed as well? Can you kind of help me understand, you know, who's going to pay for the cost of this? And then what kind of estimates of how much they're going to increase it? If they felt that $2 per ton was insufficient, how much are they looking to increase it outside of this change item?
Commissioner Bowerly? Mr. Cummings?
Representative Anderson, Chair Davids, this would be something we would try and make sure that this rate is calculated on the same way that an industrial waste is. So this would be gone if we're talking a lot about construction waste and other types of waste. So in terms of household waste, we don't believe that this would go back to the consumer, but there are other types of waste where there would be likely a rate increase in this case, but only in terms of the but it's going to be done in the same way that industrial waste is done. So,
Chair Anderson.
And Mr. Chair, but we're assuming on the solid waste portion, so that would come down to the homeowner. We're assuming that the companies that provide that service to our homeowners are not going to pass that on to the consumers. Is that the assumption? Because if it is, I'm a little, that makes me really nervous, because, I mean, all the academics point that all of these costs get passed on to the consumer in the end.
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Representative Anderson. I didn't mean to make that claim that that this wouldn't necessarily be passed on to the consumer. I was just trying to make the case that this was a certain specified type of waste. So in terms of the household waste, this is a different type of waste. So that was the only point. I wasn't trying to make a point that this wouldn't be passed through.
Commissioner Bowerly, to the Anderson question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, you also ask about the amount of the increase that we would anticipate. And so at this point, it would go from about $2 to about $2.50. So it's not a large dollar amount increase. And it is, although it is captured in solid waste as the larger category, this is really about demolition waste and industrial waste. So to the extent a homeowner may be, you know, revamping their home and they need a bin outside, you know, a large bin outside of their home, certainly we would probably expect that that would get passed on. We do always anticipate that these costs are passed on. And I want to apologize. I just got a note. My notes were wrong. It would be about $3.50 a ton that would change. And so, but it wouldn't be for your regular garbage pickup. It would be about demolition waste. So if you were rebuilding the second floor of your home and you need a dumpster outside of your house, and it would make that consistent with industrial waste.
And Mr. Chair, final one. I assume home construction, any remodeling, this would impact that. And I'm assuming that this would also impact our road construction. I'm guessing that that's part of that. And I wonder if those numbers then are accounted for in the governor's budget when it comes to roads, because obviously that's going to increase the price of of road building and whatnot. And we can talk more about it offline, but I think it would be helpful to know if they've factored in that increase in road construction costs into their overall transportation budget.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chairman, Chair Anderson, we would be happy to get more detail on that and get back to you about some of the detail and the costs associated and where they would trickle out into other parts of the system.
Chair Anderson. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as we just started talking about transportation, I'd like to ask a few questions in regards to that. And from the governor's proposal, it appears that we're going to be looking at wholesale gas pricing as far as a tax goes. And currently we're doing something different. And so sometimes it's easy to use, I'm not going to use the word gimmick, but to really talk about how we change the thought processes about what we're taxing. And 6.5% seems like something that everybody would say, well, we pay about that in sales tax for a lot of things, so it makes sense. But yet when we pull it together, I think we need to look at the overall picture. So the question that I ask of the commissioner is, do you know the current tax that we have per gallon tax on both federal and state, what that would reflect in actual tax percentage for our current pricing?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the current state gas tax rate is 28 cents a gallon, and the federal is, I'm looking at my colleague, is 18. And so if the proposal, as I mentioned, has a floor of $2.50, so that would be a minimum of 16 cents a gallon in addition. And just to make sure that I'm clear, this would be in addition to the existing gas tax. It's not a substitution for it. And so all of that would be added at the wholesale level. And then what we know from the industry is that the pump price reflects those taxes, and then plus there is, you know, their distribution costs to those companies. There's obviously a profit margin, marketing costs, those sorts of things that are also reflected in the ultimate pump price.
Representative Petersburg.
Yeah, thank you. And I was just kind of trying to clarify for me, because of my calculations, I did some calculations and I'm not sure if I'm correct, but the current 28.5 cents, I believe, for a state, and 18.4% or cents for the federal, comes to 47 cents basically of the $1.90 that we're currently paying. When you divide that out over the $1.43 that the actual price is, we're looking at about 32.8% tax on that particular gallon of gas. Even if we were to go to $3.90, which it was a few years ago, we'd still be looking at about a 13% current tax rate for gasoline, adding on the 6% or 6% and or 6.5% puts it real close to 40% at current rate. So the question, that follow-up question that I have in this regard: are you aware of any other product or service that we're currently charging that kind of tax rate on currently, of anything else,
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm not.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you again, and that's kind of my understanding too, is that this really is something that we really expanded upon. The other part of the transportation question that I would ask is that just clarification, because I see we're trying to increase ridership 80% on our transit systems, which I think is a laudable opportunity for us to do that. My question is, it's unclear as whether or not there are additional costs figured into the budget. As we know, currently the ridership comes with it a subsidy by some government entity for taxing authority to subsidize that at anywhere from 65% to 75% subsidy for that. Is the budget built into that factor, this additional 80% ridership, and is that subsidy figured into that, or is this just the infrastructure for developing those ridership?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to need to get back to you on that specific question about how that whether that subsidy is built into the budget. I don't want to speak for another department in terms of what the details of their proposal are. So thank I apologize. I'll need to get back to you.
Representative.
Thank you for that. And if you could follow up, I appreciate that. And that ends my questioning.
Okay. Okay. I have on my list McDonnell, Loeffler, Carlson, Druskowski, Barrett, Knobloch. And we will, I don't want to cut anybody off. And like I said, we would have some more time next week to continue. But Commissioner, if you want to excuse yourself, the appointed time has arrived.
Okay, thank you.
So don't go away mad, just go away. Please, and I just want to thank you for this presentation. It was a wonderful presentation. I think it really helps the committee members to understand what we're looking at here very clearly, and as soon as you can get the actual bill form, that would be great. But thank you for your work on this and your presentation today. So who would you like to take your place? Well, not that anybody could take your place, but who would you like to fill in for you temporarily?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your time today. I am going to leave you in the very able hands of Mr. Cummings, the deputy, and he can be assisted by members of the department staff as he asks them to join him.
Okay, so we will continue, and thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Okay, we will continue with Mr. Cummings, and we do have other department folks here that can help out. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Representative Petersburg had a lot of the questions that I had, so I'll just keep it short. And then, Mr. Cummings, if you could answer a question on the motor vehicle leases. Now, it says at the end of the slide, no impact to the taxpayer, and that's always a good thing. Although I think anything the government does, it's always an impact to the taxpayer. But that said, taking the 6.875 that is currently for the motor vehicle leases, and then just taking a portion of that and give it to the legacy, is that what I heard Commissioner speak to? Just curious if that is the truth, and then what is the fund balance in that particular account, and what amount will be lost and go into the legacy instead of transportation?
Mr. Cummings?
Representative Dick McDonald, Mr. Chair, as it relates to the motor vehicle lease sales tax, I'll tell you how it's currently done and how we're proposing to have it done. Currently, we are directed under law in order to give all of the proceeds from the 6.875% to the transit and transportation accounts from the motor vehicle lease sales tax. So that is what we do. We are also directed under the Constitution to give the 3.38 cents to the legacy. So currently, when we receive this money in, we are transferring 6.875 to the transit and transportation accounts, and then we're also transferring the 3.8 cents over to the legacy funds. Now that means that there's a transfer of 6.25 that we're asked to do under law. So we are trying to correct it, and then we're also making a correction in the future so that it's clarified, so that when a sales tax is to be given is dedicated, that the 6.5 is dedicated and the 0.375 continues to go to legacy. So we're going to make those two clarifications. So in terms of the consumer will see no difference in terms of this. But as it relates to the funds, the general fund will receive a benefit because of this, and the transit and transportation accounts will have a smaller amount. Now, in terms of what that will be, that is something that I can follow up with you on, Representative McDonald. The fund balance for those accounts after these two amounts are taken down.
Representative McDonald.
That's very good. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cummings, on the statewide tobacco regulation proposal, you know, tobacco taxation is one of those things where we try and address a couple of different policy issues through our policies. And one of the major reasons for increasing the tobacco tax was actually to reduce youth use of tobacco. And the recent studies by the Department of Health have proven really amazing success in that policy, actually discouraging young people from taking up this very expensive and health-endangering habit. But we rely on our local governments to actually do the underage sting operations with straw buyers to make sure that local convenience stores and others are not providing that access to the young teenagers or preteens who'd like to try it and unfortunately too often get addicted. And my understanding is that their local license to sell tobacco is what supports that monitoring process. And so I just want to encourage you to talk to the public health community and our local governments, because I'm not sure if your state tax collectors are really interested in organizing and recruiting teenagers to do that important function. And I think there needs to be some balance here.
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, we do. We work with the local units of government in terms of their various licenses, but this would be a different license for a different reason. Many times, we are trying to work with the local units of government, and sometimes we have great success, and other times we have a limited amount of success. So, in terms of trying to deal with the license, the problem that we're seeing at the Department of Revenue is the sale of untaxed tobacco products, and that some there are instances in which retailers are buying that, and then that puts, you know, them at a competitive advantage with the people who are playing by the rules, with the various gas stations and the grocers and the retailers who are buying the taxed tobacco products, buying the stamped cigarettes in order to do that. So we wanted to make sure that we had a way in which we were able to ensure that the actions that needed to be taken in order to make sure there was a level playing field are able to be done. And what we're finding right now is the local patchwork of licensure. They're not able to support the types of things that we're looking for. But as we work towards this session, we look forward to working with all that are interested in terms of thinking about this. We've reached out to the grocers, to the retailers, to the Petroleum Marketers Association. And we're going to put on our thinking caps about how to make sure that this works the best.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you.
Chair Carlson. Okay, we'll come back to him when he gets back. Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummins, the modernization of the railroad property tax proposal. I'm told that the Federal Railroad Revitalization and Regulatory Reform Act actually prohibits railroads from being treated differently than other commercial and industrial property within a state, and certainly most or all commercial industrial property in Minnesota, personal property like trains, train cars, etc., is not included under the property tax. Is this legal?
Supreme Court Chief Justice Cummings.
Mr. Chair and Chair Drazkowski, thanks for the question. You know, the 4R Act is something that that's obviously a part of what is going on, and so that's the reason why there isn't any sort of change in class rate. We're not changing class rates for railroads. We're not saying that they should increase more. But part of what we, part of what we're trying to do is make sure that just as other types of utilities are paying their fair share, are the railroads paying theirs? So the type of, in terms of the assessment is very, very outdated. It's decades old. So we want to make sure that just as other types of utilities are using their modern forms of assessment, that we're using that for this too. So there's, you know, as the commissioner was talking about, there's a prescribed weighting for how something should be assessed. Now, when we're trying to decide how much something should be assessed, sometimes the best way to assess it is based on if there's a sale. A lot of times in railroads, there aren't sales. So this is something we can't use all the time, but when there are sales, that's the best approach to use to determine somebody's market value. But under current law, we're not able to use sales to completely weight the sale of a railroad. We have to take it out into various weighting approaches. So there's many different ways in which we're just trying to apply modern techniques. Now, as it relates to the rolling stock, rolling stock is something that is taxed in most other states. You know, the vast majority, we're trying to get a census together, but as we're looking through, you know, rolling stock is something that is common. So that is something that, you know, bringing that to the Minnesota tax code would not be, it's something done in many other states. So,
Mr. Cummings, I think the Drazkowski question is a pretty important one. That, you know, I'm sure that you're legal folks have looked at it, but it'll be for further discussion. Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Cummings. So just related to Mr. Cummings, have you analyzed the treatment of that CI property in those other states to see if those railroads are treated consistently in terms of whether they're taxed or not related to other CNI properties, regular business properties? Are they? That might be that might be what you're looking at there. I don't know, but clearly the federal law says that you have to treat railroads the same way as you treat other businesses, and on its face, this proposal appears to violate that, and would violate federal law if that's the case. So I have the same concern, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Cummins. Third-party leasing companies own a lot of railroad cars and some of this rolling stock, and then they lease it out to railroad companies. Would they fall under this as well?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, Chair Drazkowski, I'm gonna write down this question, and I'm going to get back to you on this. I want to make sure I'm getting you the right answer. But, you know, it is a property tax, so it would be taxed. I just want to make sure that is it the lessor or the lessee, just to get back to you on that.
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question in this vein, Mr. Cummings. So what happens if this is struck down? What's the governor's what does he propose to do if this would be adopted in the budget and struck down? Would we then have would the state levy stay the same, or would we would it be adjusted? I mean, would other businesses have to fill in the hole that was created when it struck down?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, Chair Drazkowski, we are confident that this is something that this is within federal law, that that this is something that treats the utilities the same across the state. The connection with the CI levy is disconnected. It's part of the same proposal, but it one doesn't trigger the other. So there would be a change to the CI levy, and then in addition, we're trying to modernize these property taxes, and we do use an estimate, but there is not a trigger between the two.
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Cummins.
Chair Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cummings, I've got two questions, if I may, but the first one also happens to deal with the rolling stock. And my question centers on the routing. I remember years ago I was involved with some trade issues when Governor Perpich was in office, and
there was a major purchase of grain by Taiwan, and it made a world of difference as to which direction those trains went or what route they took in terms of whether it was Minnesota grain or grain from the Dakotas, and it was a trade agreement that we had entered into. So my question is basically that, keeping that in mind, but also, you know, they could go to the West Coast or they could go through Duluth. And would there be a potential impact on the port of Duluth if they decided to route those trains? I don't know if there's a direct route down to Omaha, for example, going south, but or to the West Coast is what they did back then. They actually made two purchases, and the government of Taiwan, for a variety of reasons, mainly because of Perpich's visit and then the history of some of them that some of them had with Minnesota, they wanted to make sure it was Minnesota grain. So they insisted whatever route it was that it be followed to make sure that it was Minnesota grain. But my point is railroads have alternatives. And have you looked in terms of what the impact may or may not be on the Port of Duluth? How that grain is loaded, and then I've got a follow-up question on another issue.
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, in terms of the routing through the state, you know, this we're trying to deal with the property tax of this. So as it relates, you know, railroads pay other types of taxes like the corporate tax or other things that are applied to them. But in terms of the property tax, it is based on the market value. So from what I understand, Wisconsin, you know, and most other states, you know, do tax rolling stock as part of their property tax. So in terms of the effect that this would have on other types of, on how they would route it through, that could be something that would happen on the commerce side, but I'm not sure if that would impact a decision to route something through. But that's something I can ask my team about. And
yeah, Mr. Chairman, sure, I'd appreciate that, and I know that you and I had an earlier conversation, and you mentioned that other states do this.
Yeah.
I'm not sure all of them have the equivalent of a Great Lakes port, you know, that what the impact might be there. That's what basically my question is. Looks like there's an answer.
The gentleman would like to join us here. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Sure. My name is John Cloxie. I'm the Assistant Director for Property Tax within the Department of Revenue.
Do you work for Paul?
We all work for Paul.
Okay. Thank you. to the Carlson question.
As far as your question regarding the valuation, when we do unitary valuation, it's a valuation on the entire company, even that portion of the company that is not within Minnesota. And then we do have an allocation to the state for that, and then a further apportionment to the individual parcels that they own.
Chair Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, and I'll take that, but it would not have a negative impact on which route they took or on the Port of Duluth.
To the gentleman?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Well, Chair Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, I did have another question, sure. And that dealt with the motor vehicle leases proposal. And my question, Mr. Cummings, is would that proposal change the distribution of those dollars at all? And the reason I ask that is that last session when we were dealing with some of these issues involving the automobile leases, distribution became a question, and Hennepin and Ramsey, during an earlier legislative session, I don't know how many years back, were left out of the distribution formula, and that became an issue last session, and rather than redoing the whole formula, Hennepin and Ramsey were provided projects through another fiscal vehicle for some bridges and so on, and an interchange, I think, in St. Paul, a bridge in Minneapolis, to try to bring about some balance. But does part of this proposal make any changes relative to the distribution, and in particular Hennepin and Ramsey?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, I'm going to, first of all, there's a lot of formula changes that may be going on related to the larger transportation proposal and how those funds would be distributed. So with that said, I'm going to, many of the distributions on many of the funds, this is a time in which, you know, they're trying to work that through. But as it relates to the motor vehicle lease proposal here, this does not change the type of distribution that would go to either the transit or the transportation accounts related as we are trying to move some of the money from those accounts to the general fund in order to correct this. But there wouldn't be any changes to any distributions related to that. So the changes were not made. As it, you know, those accounts continue to grow over time. The first $32 million is taken out from the general fund, and then those other two accounts are, there's a formula that goes into how those are spent, but this proposal doesn't change those.
Senator Carlson. And Mr. Chairman, I have no idea why Hennepin and Ramsey were originally let out or not covered with that distribution formula, but I guess that's a question for the Transportation Committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Vice Chair Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummings, I'm looking on page 2 and just have a couple questions regarding the information on page 2. First of all, I wanted to follow up on your comment earlier. You had mentioned something about fair share. I know Governor Dayton at times in the past has been very clear about who would be the recipients of his tax increases. So I want to know, regarding the gas tax proposal, who's going to be paying the $4.4 billion in the next 10 years?
Mr. Cummings?
The Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, the
I'm sorry,
the gross are you referring to the gross receipts tax, Representative Barrett?
Vice Chair Barrett.
I'm referring to the 6.5% tax on the annual per gallon wholesale price of gasoline. Yeah.
Mr. Cummings?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, this is something that will be paid by the distributors at the same point the gas tax is paid. We assume that the distributors would be putting that as part of the price, and that the price would be paid by individuals who buy gasoline across the state.
Vice Chair Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cummings, so so regarding the $4.4 billion tax increase, what that's variable based on the price per gallon, or the price per gallon. So I'm wondering about that. What's your average price per gallon you're using in your equation?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, let me, Representative Barrett.
Or maybe staff could help on that. Was it 330 with a minimum of 250?
Yeah, so Mr. Chair, this is the wholesale gross receipts. I'm sorry, the wholesale, it's based on wholesale. And so what we're using is we're using the U.S. Energy Information Administration in order to try and get what those, our estimate is based on those prices for what we expect the wholesale price to be. So the expected wholesale price, and again, this is something that we have now and we're going to update through forecasts, but the expected wholesale price in 2016 is $2.70, and so that is, and obviously right now we have the retail price at about $2, right? A little less than $2. But they are also assuming that in the summer months, you know, that would be a higher price. So it's the average annual wholesale price for gasoline.
Vice Chair Barrett?
Well, that brings me to my final point, and it kind of piggybacks on something some other folks were saying. You know, just doing my my back of the napkin math here, I see a tax increase of around 56% based on what people are currently paying. That's at $2 per gallon, 56% increase. And if the price goes up to about $3.30, $3.50, my math shows me we'll be number one in the country in a gas tax. We're now about 18th. I mean, that's how dramatic this tax increase is on middle and low-income Minnesotans. It's that regressive, that the more they pay at the pump, the more they'll pay, and the higher we'll get to number one in the country. Is that how you see it, too?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, in terms of the price of this is Throughout the next 10 years, the price is actually expected to go down, and then it's expected to rise a little. So even in a 10-year horizon, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, which is something that the industry uses and nonpartisan analysts uses, they don't expect to see that price go above 270 in the next 10 years. The first, I think it's going to go 270, and then it will lower, and then it will start to increase over time. But so seeing a wholesale price of 350 is not within the current foreseeable future.
Vice Chair Barron?
Well, thank you. I know we're out of time here, but I know nobody thought that gas prices would go below $2, but they have. So the fact that the experts think something, I think I go by history, and I look at history and determine whether that history will repeat itself. And gas prices in total have gone over $4 for a vast majority of the last few years. And if that happens, which is, in my opinion, a highly likely occurrence, we will become number one in the country in gas price and gas tax from 18. So that's not a question, it's a statement. And I think that's very regressive and very detrimental to the folks that are driving 50 miles to work every day, like they are in Chisago County. It's going to be very hurtful to those people who are making a few dollars, don't have a lot of extra income. They have a little now because gas prices went down, but when gas prices go up, they're going to be hurting twice. The price is going up and the tax is going up at the exact time they can't afford it. And that's how I see that gas tax plan of $4.4 billion. Thank you.
Vice Chair Baird, did you say pay at the pump or play at the pump?
I said pay dearly at the pump.
Oh, okay. That's bad. Well, that's commerce today, isn't it? Play at the pump. Okay, Chair Knobloch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cummings. And stop me, Chair Davids, if this question has already been asked, but is it the position of the department that the proceeds of the gross receipts tax will be distributed in an identical way as to the proceeds of the gas tax?
Chair Cummings.
Mr. Chair Knobloch, we believe that to be the case. And again, that's a distributional thing, so I'm going to get back to you. I know that's important to you. But I will get back to you just to confirm that. But we believe that the distributions would be the same as under the gas tax. But I'm just going to check on that for you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Cummings.
Thank you.
Chair Knobloch.
That was my only question, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Simonson.
I'm going to pass.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummins, I have a few questions. When you determined that you would increase the child dependent care credit, did you look at the history behind what's happened in that industry, and I'm talking about the child care industry now, in regard to every time we've increased the credit? And I know there have been regulations added, so that accounts for it, but it seems to me this will be a wash because child care providers will increase their fee, because just like we see with college tuition, the more grant money we provide, the higher the tuition becomes. So did you look at that history at all when you determined that this would be a good idea? Now, I'm not saying it's not a good idea. I'm just wondering what's the relationship in regard to what's happened historically.
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I think when the proposal was put together and then also when it was estimated, it was just looking at the practical impact of the proposal. In terms of how this may work into the future or how this would impact rates in the future, this is this was not that's not a revenue part of the revenue estimate. I will say, Mr. Chair, as we're sort of talking about the various elements of the child and dependent care, when we talk to various families over time to try and talk about the impact of child care on their life, the amount of credit that we would be getting from this is so small in comparison to some of the child care bills that young families are having to deal with. So this is, in terms of would this would this credit, you know, make a difference for the amount of child care receipts? I'm not sure. But that was, the governor was really interested in trying to ensure that
parents with young children and others were supported as they were making very costly but important decisions for their families.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair,
Erickson.
Thank you. Mr. Cummins, on the tobacco slide, the establishment of a statewide license for retailers, will that include tribal casinos?
Mr. Cummins?
That's a great question.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, that's a great question.
Will you please get the answer?
The answer is no, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cummins, that was a great answer. Chair Erickson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And my last question is on the solid waste management rate. When we have regional solid waste facilities, will that increase then because of demolition waste and industrial waste, et cetera, which is also delivered to these sites? Will that pass the cost on to the users, to those of us who participate in those regional solid waste areas?
Mr. Cummins?
I looked around and I was told that that in terms of the rate that would be charged, it's something that would be passed on to the various people who are putting together that type of waste.
Chair Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then I think the last one on my list will go, and then we'll call it a day. Unless we want to talk about the governor's tax proposal more down the road, we certainly can. I don't want to cut anybody off here. Chair Swidzinski. Your last question before lunch here, so.
Okay, then I'll pass there.
No. Go ahead. Gentleman from Lyon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would actually like the fellow from the property tax division that came down and spoke about the railroads, if he could come before us, Mr. Chair. Thank
please
you.
State your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Yes, my name is John Kloxie.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question to the testifier there. You mentioned that the way you do an evaluation over a rail company's total rolling stock portfolio that they have, and then they give an allocation to the state when figuring that. How has that changed in the last 5 years with the increased flow from North Dakota with crude oil change? I mean, does that go through a yearly evaluation? And some of that, and I just kind of wanted to get some history on that. And then my second question I'll ask in one fell swoop goes towards the idea that this is going to increase and then go to local property taxes. What is currently done with the dollars that are generated, so that the taxes that are currently on rail property, where do those taxes go? Are they dedicated to buy down local property taxes currently, or is it just the addition that will go towards that? Thank you.
And to the gentleman, if you could please spell your last name. We didn't catch that.
Mr. Chair, it's Kloxiem. It's Kloxiem.
Z-I-E-M?
Yep, as in Mary.
Colombo Bakitis or whatever. To the gentleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the question that you ask is what occurred over the last 5 years. Currently, there is no rolling stock being included in the unitary valuation for railroad companies. The increase in traffic, however, speaks to their bottom line, and we get filings from the railroad companies as part of as we do with all utility companies as well, and that impacts how the valuation is calculated. Once we apportion the value to the individual parcels within the state, that value is included on the tax rolls for the local property tax.
The gentleman from Lyon.
I had a secondary question.
Okay. Mr. Cummins?
Mr. Chair, in terms of the current amount paid by railroads, that is an amount that local governments currently have in their tax base. So it is not treated differently in terms of what type of money is being able to be available. I think the point of what we were talking about before, the new money, was to say that if there's this market value through the rolling stock or through the various enhancements or the modernizations to the assessing practices, there would be additional tax base in order to, in terms of setting the levies.
Gentleman from Lyon. Okay, real quick, Representative Chair Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard something, Mr. Chair. I'm just to kind of raise, peaked a question here. I've heard railroads referred to by the department as utilities, and Mr. Michael is. do we refer to railroads or classify them as utilities, railroad companies?
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, I think the department may be talking about them as utilities because the department, in terms of its valuation responsibility, is responsible for valuing utilities and railroads. Minnesota has a sort of a different tax regime for utilities in that their personal property is taxed, but railroads, you know, are not treated like utilities per se. You know, their rates aren't regulated and they're not guaranteed a rate of return or anything like that. But there's a history that goes back. Minnesota railroads used to pay a gross receipts tax instead, that was in lieu of the property tax. That was a 5% gross receipts tax, which probably resulted in them paying like 250% more tax than what they would have paid if they were paid based on the property tax. Congress passed the 4R Act, and that forced all states, including Minnesota, to start treating railroads like other business property. And so then we went to this regime. I think the law passed in like 79, and the department has had it in place since then. And it's, you know, as the individual described, it's a unit value kind of basis, but they're not utilities per se.
Thank you, Mr. Michael and Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummings, I've heard from you and Mr. Klockzien too that I've heard the word utilities. I mean, is that what the department classifies railroads as? I haven't heard that before.
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, Chair Draskowski, I think the point that I was trying to make is that we want to, in respect to ensuring that businesses who do like types of business in terms of pipelines or railroads, that we are treating them the same in terms of assessment. So I think that's the point that I was trying to make. I didn't want to mix up terms. But I think you brought up the point about ensuring that, you know, with the 4R Act, to make sure that properties are treated the same. That's something that we really care about, too. And that's why we're bringing this railroad property tax proposal forward, to make sure that companies who, you know, do similar types of activities are treated the same, which we believe that they're not right now.
Chair Draskowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think we heard the heart of the governor's argument, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to remind Chair Draskowski that, like Monopoly, railroads are not a utility. So if you ever play that. Let the governor, too, know
and
that.
And with that, Mr. Cummings, thank you for your work. Thank you to the department. We'll see. Have a great week. Oh, we got tomorrow is the state taxes. Good government all the time. We adjourn.